The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Coleman Nochter joins us in studio. He's a child and adolescent psychotherapist, and he visits us on a regular basis to give you advice on the young people in your life and your relationships with them. Good afternoon, Coleman.
Afternoon, Ray. How are you? Good, thanks. And you?
I saw you quoted in an article about parents at sporting events.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What goes on there? Because some parents just overdo it a bit, don't they?
Yeah, I think there's something about perhaps us trying to vicariously live our own sporting desires through our children. You can kind of see it yourself a little bit. I mean, as a sideline parent yourself, you have to kind of bite your tongue. But it's usually around trying to direct your child how to play the game better. But that escalates into almost when you've parents shouting assault of comments at an under nines team or the opposition or somebody who misses a ball. I mean, they blame a lot on tablets. And I'd be the first person to say the technology is an awful thing for kids and sport and sedentary lifestyle. I tell you, more kids that I see now are opting out of sport because of that environment.
Are they?
Absolutely. That they can't stand the tension of it and the seriousness of it and the kind of coaches and people getting really upset if they drop the ball. It's through all levels. I mean, I just thinking like when I started playing, I think the earliest underage group I could come in at was under 11. Now we've these kind of academies where you're playing at 4 and right the way up, you're kind of being, and there's a lovely kind of coaching, nurturing side to that, but there's always a competitive side and there's always be people on the sideline who take that too far.
Is that not good? Does that not prepare you for life?
Not in that way.
I mean,
resilience is not... We have this thing that we need to have adversity to be resilient and we need to show tough times. It's not about... Resilience is about a good knowledge of yourself and your own limitations and being able to work within a good... having a good relationship with yourself that you can absorb adversity.
Right.
You don't actually have to have adversity to do that.
Because I was arguing this point recently because I did gymnastics as a young lad.
It's a very disciplinary sport.
And it's a performance thing. A lot of nerves involved. You're on your own. You can't blame anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And you're out there. And if you mess up, you mess up very publicly. And
sure.
I was arguing that was a great preparation for life for me.
For some.
Yes.
I mean, there's young people who will probably thrive on that challenge and, you know, you're able to self-motivate, you're able to self-discipline, you're able to practice and you're able to focus on taking criticism and taking that as something that betters you. And healthy striving is good. You know, you want to be better at something. But for a child who's vulnerable and is there for the social aspect, who doesn't perhaps have that, just hasn't got that competitive temperament and they're just there to enjoy the game, they would find that, and if it's introduced too early. I mean, the idea that sport should be something that is at for all levels and isn't really that competitive early on and becomes more intense the better you get. But if you're shouting at someone at a Go Games who's 7 for not being able to solo
the ball. So, word of caution for pushy parents.
Yeah, but I think the sport thing, I mean, we're seeing it spilling into attacks on referees. We're seeing these in club games, these assaults and Sean Kavanagh's face and all these things. There's something about our society that's kind of, we're not... More, our boundary around what is socially appropriate is getting looser. And I think when you see that encroaching on underage sporting events and children and matches having to be abandoned because, and this is underage games, and referees getting locked in dressing rooms for their own safety.
Definitely not the spirit of fair play.
But I'd say to you, this is coming a while. I was writing about this back in 2013, that I just felt these silent sidelines and things were new and that we're getting more.
Because they do that in other countries, that in other countries you're not allowed to shout from the sideline.
Absolutely, and probably rightly so from that point of view. And it's sad to say that we might have to impose those things on parents who are coming, who want the best for their child. And, you know, they're interested, they're bringing them to these occasions. And most coaches, 9 out of 10 coaches, are really good in nurturing and supporting them. But it only takes one. And it's an indictment of perhaps our own competitiveness and expectations. And we just need to chill a bit.
Relax. Right. Okay, we said you were coming in and here are some of our listeners' problems and questions. Hi, Coleman. I have a 14-year-old son who suffers from anxiety and when he gets stressed, he vomits. It's affecting school. It's extremely difficult to see. My marriage broke up 3 years ago and he is a sibling with autism. I would like to bring him to counselling. Can you advise where is the best place to go?
First of all, I mean, it's a really good link that you've made, the link between the vomiting and the anxiety already, because this is young boys, especially when they're anxious, they don't tend to express that in conventional ways. They don't tend to be kind of shy or anxious. They can be angry and frustrated, and you get this a lot, which is the somatic symptom. So right. You get a lot of pains in tummies, I can't go to school, I've got cramps, etc. And the somatic symptom is where you don't really have the language to explain how you feel, so it manifests itself in the body. And this oftentimes treated young boys of this age, where we'd call it kind of cyclical vomiting syndrome, which is essentially called migraine of the tummy. So it's aggravated by
stress.
What's really interesting is this, obviously the separation, the parental separation would be stressful, but the sibling with autism, I see a lot of this actually, where there's a child who has a sibling who has needs or special needs, and that child becomes very visible within the family. There's lots of appointments to go to. They probably have, you know, extra support and scaffolding around them. And the child who doesn't have the symptom tends to feel a little bit invisible. Now, they can't take it out on their parents. It's not no one's fault, but they just feel that perhaps they're being missed out. In some cases, what develops is a child's understanding that I need to be sick to be seen. And then you see another symptom developing so that I can seek nurturance and care and attention through my tummy or my vomiting or whatever it might be, because I find it more difficult to ask for it in general terms. And it'd be really important.
That may be the case, may not be the case.
It's an important dynamic within families. That oftentimes happen. As regards to advice where you go, I mean, the public service would be the CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. It's a catchment-based area, so find out what your local one is. If you can afford it, maybe psychotherapy in the community, find someone who specialises in children and adolescents. I'd very rarely advise anyone in particular because it's about the fit.
Okay, yes,
but for to suit your own needs, they'd be the two routes I'd go.
Okay, and you know, we've seen it on primetime specials about CAMHS, and we've heard it here on the show, that waiting lists can be very long.
Far too long. Supply does not meet demand.
No. And it depends where you are in the country. It's a bit of a lottery there. Okay, hope that works out. Comment, my 10-year-old is looking for a phone from Santa for Christmas. How do you manage peer pressure around mobile phone ownership and usage as well? There's a lot of pressure and I don't want him to be different to his peers. I'm resisting as he writes his Santa letter because we're trying to keep screens to a minimum. Help.
Yeah, I mean, the question about what age is the right age is always comes up. We've answered that before. There's an urban myth that it's 12 or 13. If that's the urban myth, we'll always undercut that by a year or two. So now it's 10. The issue here is not about age. It's about your own child's ability to cope with that online world. And you're giving them a portal to the outside world. And, you know, a colleague of mine would often say, when you're comfortable with a child seeing pornography, then that's when you give them the phone. And I think we've spoken about that as well. In this situation, for me, 10 is too young under any circumstances. No matter how mature the 10-year-old is, I don't believe they would have the capacity to cope with what that is. But the real issue here is the peer pressure. And again, you know, this if my child's not playing Fortnite, they'll be this social outcast. And they may well be in that class, in the minority of the children who can't do it. But I would always say to us, why do we follow the lowest common denominator? The first parent to break sets the tone. Mm. And I would say to this parent, hold your own. I mean, the Santi letter is difficult to write, but we can explain that, you know, Santi has limits as well in terms of that. But from the point of view of, if you are the unpopular parent when it comes to technology, my guess is that time will prove you right.
Yeah.
And I think you need to hold on to that idea.
Difficult, it's difficult.
Really difficult, really difficult. But again, this is your child, this is your house, this is your rules, and you have to do within your own subculture, you have to create what you believe is best for them and not be drawn into the masses of what other people feel is okay for their child. Really difficult. Acknowledge his upset. Acknowledge that it must be really difficult to not have them when other people have them, but his time will come.
Okay, and I mean this sincerely, good luck with that. We are finding it hard to understand, this is the next one, we're finding it hard to understand a grandchild aged 8 who utterly refuses to speak to adults, including relatives, other than her parents. She's an only child, her mother talks to her in Spanish, her father is English. Her father in English, sorry, in English. Please advise.
Yeah, I think the language issue is interesting here. We have this kind of belief system that bilingualism in children is, you know, just unequivocally good for them. And because they're sponges, they can learn all these languages. I think emotionally it's interesting because I've spoken to children who have bilingualism, and whether they dream in certain languages or feel in certain languages and then trying to translate that, it does create some degree of anxiety around emotionality. It's great for their language development and their Leaving Cert points, but from the point of view of emotionality, I wouldn't be 100% sure that it's an absolute.
Go on, tease that out for me.
I just think, I suppose it would have dealt with a lot of children who perhaps were coming in as refugees and things like that, and would have been really difficult. And in those situations, that symptom, where the psychosomatic symptom, where the language might be difficult to articulate emotionality, it's really difficult to articulate sadness and depression if it's not part of your lexicon of terms.
That's your first language,
and, and mental health and mental symptoms, they're social constructions. So a psychiatric hospital in Africa will have different presentations to a psychiatric hospital in Dublin.
Right.
And in the absence of those words and those language, it can be really difficult. This child is only 8. And so they may be shy and they might be fearful of adults. But
so I'm taking it that they're living here. They're Spanish mother, English, Irish father, and they're only talking in Spanish. This is what I'm taking, and that sort of excludes all the adults who can't speak Spanish, obviously.
Perhaps, you know, it says her father speaks in English.
Yes.
But that may not be, she may not be as finely tuned in that, or else she may be in school.
No, I take it that she can't speak English, she's just choosing not to. Yeah,
and if it's a choice, there's a condition called selective mutism. I haven't seen it in many years. It's one of the things I would have seen earlier on in my career, small children who refuse to either speak to a certain cohort, so they won't speak outside of their parents, or refuse to speak at all.
Right.
And it's incredibly interesting little condition because they can speak and they do speak and they have vocal skills, but they choose not to use them.
Okay.
It's incredibly powerful within a dynamic and can be a symptom of anxiety.
What but advice would you give to this
person? Go to a speech and language therapist first, just to assess it, just to see where it is. And she'll or he will point you in the right direction as to whether, again, you might need some psychotherapeutic intervention around it,
right,
because it could be that. But just the language at home thing is interesting.
Okay. Rain Coleman, I've heard you talking about alcohol abuse and teens before, but what about other substance abuse, especially cannabis? There's such a permissive attitude to it, and I think there are a lot of negative health effects which can't be written off even if it's legal in countries like Canada now. Many thanks.
Yeah, there's a lot of discourse at the moment, and I think it's driven by the medicinal cannabis argument that, you know, with children...
Like in a number of states in America now, it's legal to, you know, to sell cannabis, not just for medicinal purposes.
Sure, I think that's compounded by the argument that it reduced criminality and
Portugal has decriminalized possession of drugs, small amounts of drugs.
Yeah, my own personal experience of working with young people, for me, cannabis there's an unmistakable link between that and certain mental health conditions. More than likely, the older adolescent who might have a psychotic illness or hearing voices, and the use of cannabis in those conditions is too much to be a coincidence in that sense. Now, whether young people are using the cannabis in order to manage hearing voices or manage the anxiety, and so they get that calming effect from it, or else it predates the voices, was their abuse of cannabis, which has triggered this kind of symptom profile. It's very hard to establish that. Whatever the case is, in none of the cases have I ever seen it work well. It exacerbates the symptoms and makes them worse over time, or agitates the person who is experiencing that. And when a young person is suffering from those symptoms, stops taking cannabis, their condition improves over time. But obviously in that detox period where they're coming off it, it may well be agitated. So for me, my colleague Dr. Bobby Smith would speak very openly about this, that he just thinks there isn't an argument for cannabis use at all in terms of whether it's legalized or whatever the case may be. I don't have his level of experience, but just from my anecdotal experience, I've seen it used. It's definitely more than a coincidence. Yeah. Whether it's the cause and effect, I'm not entirely sure.
How do you stop people doing it, though? How do you, if you have a teenager who's doing it, like it's difficult.
It's difficult to stop a teenager doing anything from the point of view.
Right,
I mean, you're trying to motivate them to conform, and you can do that through restricting them and saying you're not having any money, you're not having access to the outside world, or you can try and get that internal motivation that they choose to say no to it. Second one's obviously always better
yes.
But it's more time investment. It's more, that's a labour over time that you're trying to teach morality. And choice and conscience.
And that has to start at a way younger age.
Oh yeah, you're talking primary school at that stage. It's not, you know, you don't pull in your 17-year-old and say, I'm going to have a chat to you about drugs.
No.
They probably know 10 times more than you at that point.
Yeah. Okay, and good luck with that. Coleman, thanks so much for coming in, and Coleman will return in about 4 weeks' time. That's it from us. Mary Wilson is on the way with more on Brexit, I would imagine, and we're back at 3 o'clock tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday.
The Ray Darcy Show.